An update on malignant hyperthermia by Ronald S. Littman, professor of anesthesiology and pediatrics, Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania, and director, clinical research, Department of Anesthesiology and Critical Care, the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. Dr. Littman spoke at the 68th Annual Postgraduate Assembly in Anesthesiology, presented by the New York State Society of Anesthesiologists.
Hi, everyone. Good morning. I do have a couple of conflicts since I originally did that form that they send you months ago. I've been paid by Becton Dickinson to give a talk on medication safety in the operating room, and I am a board member of MHouse, and we get some funding, although I don't personally get anything, we get some funding from Eagle Pharmaceuticals, the maker of the new Dantrolene, which I'll tell you about in a little bit, and I've attended some events that they've sponsored. So years ago, I met an amazing guy named Henry Rosenberg, and he's the president of MHouse. He was one who originally got me interested in malignant hyperthermia, and that was back in the late 90s. And since then, I've been very active with the society. Over the past year, I've become the head of the hotline. I hope you all know about the MH hotline that you can call. And so I started a database that logs all the calls, and we're going to hopefully do a good amount of research stemming from that. So in looking for hot topics right off the press, I looked at the New York newspapers, and here's what we got this week. We've got some guidelines changes that MHouse is coming out with. All these are so new that they may not even be on the website soon, but keep looking for them. They will be there, and I'll go over those in a moment. I want to tell you also about the current issue of anesthesia and analgesia, where we have this great article that shows that if you don't use core temperature monitoring, then your mortality from MH increases. And I also want to pay tribute to an amazing guy, Michael Denborough, who we lost this year. Dr. Denborough was the first person to ever describe MH. Back in Australia, I believe the publication was in 1962 in Lancet. And it was a guy who came into the operating room with a broken leg after a car accident. And he said, "You cannot give me anesthesia." And they're like, "Why not?" He said, "Because every one of my six relatives died every time they get anesthesia. There's something about it with our family." And they said, no, that's okay. Don't worry. We have this new drug, halothane. And you'll be fine. We promise." And so they gave him the halothane. What do you think happened? He triggered and he developed MH, and they didn't have Dantrolene at that time. So they packed him in ice and they saved him. And since then, Dr. Denborough, who was not an anesthesiologist, he was an internist with a specialty or an interest in genetics. He sat down with the guy and his family. He mapped out the whole pedigree, and he was really the one who first described the dominant inheritance. Another great thing in the news recently, as you all know, Henry Rosenberg has been the face of MH for many years. I wish he could be here this morning, but he wasn't able to. But he finally won the ASA's Distinguished Service Award. We're really proud of Henry. Many anesthesiologists have done great things over their careers. Honestly, when I think back to everyone's contributions, I can't think of anyone who has probably saved more lives than Henry through his promotion, his education of MH, his development of the hotline many years ago, and we're really proud of him. These are some, just to give you an idea of what we're dealing with on the MH hotline, some statistics from this past year. MH is seen all over the country. There's pockets of MH in certain areas of the country, but in general, those anesthesiologists and those patients and their families tend to know about each other. So I would say that there's really no predisposition for any particular place. It occurs all over North America, except New Mexico and Wyoming. That's pretty much it. We've got 31 hotline consultants now. So far for 2014, we've fielded over 400 calls, over 200 website queries. By the way, there's a part on the website where it says you want to ask an expert, you'll get an answer within 3 days. Please don't make it an emergency, okay? Just call us for that. Here's some statistics we put together. I don't know if you could see the bottom, but this is just ages, 1 to 9. So we get a lot of calls for kids. A lot of this has to do with fever in the perioperative area. Fever itself is not usually an indicator of MH. It sort of covers the spans of life here, except really early and really late. And that's probably just a reflection of the types of people having surgery. This is the diagnosis that we have. So this is likely MH, possibly MH, unlikely. So most of the calls we get are not MH. There are people asking about signs and symptoms or asking about how to treat people with different disorders. But I think in general, we get about 1 or 2 cases in North America a week, about. Some weeks we don't have any, some weeks we have 3 or 4. So I think it averages out. And I've seen some statistics that say about 75 cases a year in the United States. As far as fatalities, we know about 1 or 2 cases a year, maybe not even, maybe 1 case every 2 years, just depending upon the time period. We lost one woman this year to MH. It was here in the New York area. And it was an interesting story, which I'll actually tell you about in a little bit, because it actually helped us change some of our M House guidelines. By the way, it was her 30th anesthetic. It's unbelievable, right? We hear of people having several anesthetics before they trigger, but not 30. It turns out she was proven to have a mutation. So that's how we know it's true. And she ended up dying from MH. And one of the possible reasons is that the anesthesiologist thought that because she was on a calcium channel blocker, they should not be treating with dantrolene. The language on our website was confusing, and hopefully it will be taken off very soon. Where do they exist when we get calls? The highest one is during maintenance of general anesthesia, but over here are the PACU also. So we're getting a fair number of calls. One of the most common calls we get for cases that are not MH is from the PACU. There is an incredible amount of people out there that develop a high febrile response from anesthesia. And I don't really know what causes it. I mean, I have some theories, but it's really remarkable how many cases we get of people getting a temperature of 105, 106 in the PACU. And without other signs and symptoms, it's really not MH. In fact, I don't really know of any good cases, by the way, of MH starting after about 10 minutes of turning off the anesthetic. And so I hear from people all the time, oh, you read in the textbooks, you hear this, you hear that. So-and-so gave a lecture that you can get MH 24 to 48 hours afterwards. It's just not true. We don't know of any good cases that we could verify where that has happened. And if you look at our database, a couple of years ago in anesthesiology, I published our experience in the North American MH database of all post-op cases, and I could find 11. And of those 11 cases, of hundreds of known cases since the 70s when we started the database, of those 11, only one could I find started after 10 minutes of stopping the anesthetic. And that even that one, I couldn't really discern from the chart. Almost all cases occur before the patient leaves the OR. Let's just first go over some important MH principles, and we'll tie that into some current events that are important. So the first couple things are MH is caused by two triggers, right? We all know them, I hope. Gas and succinylcholine. There's been a lot of debate about whether or not succinylcholine really causes MH alone, and there's no question that it does, and I'll show you some evidence for that. Gas, of course, is well known. We were just having a discussion earlier before the session started that if you all are sick of hearing about MH, stop using gas. I won't have to do any more lectures. The other thing that we know is linked to MH from the recent literature is people who have suffered either heat or exercise-induced rhabdomyolysis when it's unexplainable. I mean, I'm not talking about the weekend warrior that goes out and does CrossFit for the first time, and on Monday their CKs go through the roof. We've got a number of calls about that. I'm talking about people that have had either milder or some type of unexplainable heat-related rhabdo. We're finding that about half of those people indeed either have mutations that are associated with MH or respond to a contracture test. Let's go over some recent literature. This is the oldest that I wanted to include, but I wanted to really get this out there because I don't think it's well known. Marilyn Larrick surveyed the registry, and she reported in Anesthesia and Analgesia back in 2010 the clinical characteristics of patients with MH over a pretty broad time frame. Almost all the cases here include a volatile with or without succinylcholine. She found two patients with succinylcholine only. And I think up until recently, most of us, we sort of winked our eyes at, well, the succinylcholine alone really caused MH. It really wasn't well described. But I'll get to that in a moment. I just want to tease out a couple other things from Marilyn's paper. And that's these are the clinical presenting pattern. And by far, the most common here was a respiratory acidosis, right? Your CO2 goes up. It's a hypercapnia that's hard to get down with increasing ventilation. And it's also rigidity, muscular signs. But you don't have to have rigidity. A bunch of patients here had respiratory acidosis without the rigidity. Metabolic acidosis was seen in some patients, but you don't have to have that either. And so in the past, I think, before this publication, if you're thinking about MH, I want to confirm it with a blood gas, making sure the patient has metabolic acidosis. But it turns out that that can be a late finding. And so you don't necessarily need rigidity, and you don't necessarily need a metabolic acidosis. Almost all patients had respiratory, because that's part of the definition of MH. But you don't have to have the other thing. So it could be a tricky diagnosis. The paper that really told us a lot about succinylcholine was this report from Sheila Riazzi. She runs the MH Biopsy Center in Toronto. And one of the great things about this place is that it's all government funded and all their patients can get biopsy tests. So the results from her paper here are unknown MH susceptibles. And the thing that's really cool here, she's got 20 confirmed cases. Now, again, these are biopsy proven cases of patients that triggered with succinylcholine only. So I really hope this puts this issue to rest, that although it's uncommon, and it's certainly not as common as MH developing from the inhalationals, if you give it to a susceptible person, someone with a genetic mutation, you can develop MH from succinylcholine alone. Let's get even hotter now, off the press. In this month's ANA, there is a remarkable paper by Marilyn Larrick again. She looked at the database and she looked to see how death from MH related to inadequate temperature monitoring. I'm not going to go through all the specifics, but it shows us one thing that we've known for a while, and that's when you get over a certain temperature here, deaths really start to go up, and it's really remarkable. And so, you know, when you think about when I'm on the hotline and I get a call about a patient who's having an MH crisis, the most important thing, of course, is to prevent their death. And death from MH occurs from two main reasons. The first reason is hyperkalemia. That's a little bit less common because people tend to see it and treat it. You'll start to get PVCs. If you get a young person who's got hypercapnia and all of a sudden getting PVCs and you can't figure out why, think MH, think hyperkalemia. The second most common reason, actually the first most common, but the other reason why people die is because hyperthermia that can't be corrected fast enough. I'll talk about some heat stroke issues in a moment, but as long as I'm thinking about it, we all hear of patients that die after running marathons or on the football field during practice in August. And some of those patients are MH susceptible, some are not. But one of the things that's coming up in the emergency room literature is that if you immerse these patients in cold ice baths really fast, you can prevent them from dying. And in fact, what I've heard is that at a few marathons, they actually have these ice baths to try and get people in who are developing a high fever quickly from running. And in fact, that turns out to be really good advice for us too. If you have a patient that's developing MH and their temperature is going up fast, put them in ice. Just cover them, do whatever you can to get them cool, because that's going to be probably the biggest impact on mortality. And that's what Marilyn showed here. So the other thing that this graph teases out is that the patients who died did not initially have core temperature monitoring. So another cool thing in the news is that the editors from ANA, Schaefer, Franklin Dexter, and Soren Brawl, have this great editorial, and they declared war on skin temperature monitoring. How many here use skin temperature monitoring routinely? I do. I mean, I don't use the patches, but I use the axillary temp. And that's really just not good enough. They have some really strong language. Please go online or get your ANA and look at it. They say, if you don't monitor core temperature routinely, start today. Do it right with a continuous electronic measurement of core temperature. And this is better than explaining to patients, parents, or the next of kin why you chose to save $6. It's certainly powerful thoughts. And in M-House, what we did is we changed our guidelines. We knew about Marilyn's paper probably since last spring or the summer. And when we had our guidelines meeting in September, we changed it. In the past, it used to say we recommend temperature monitoring for any case longer than 30 minutes. Now we say we recommend core temperature monitoring. It's not always easy to do. It's got to be an esophageal or nasopharyngeal or tympanic membrane. There's a decent amount of cases where those are not practical, like if you have an LMA in and a patient breathing spontaneously, but the data is what it is. I just want to talk again about hyperthermia and death, just to really drive this home. This was a girl, Stephanie. This is not a HIPAA violation. Her parents were on the Today Show. She's got a website. And she went into a plastic surgeon's office in Florida for a routine cosmetic procedure. The anesthesiologist really did nothing wrong. I reviewed this case for the Florida State Board of Health. She came in, she got the same anesthetic that any of us here in this room would do. She got her IV, she got some ANSEF, she got omadazolam, she got propofol for induction. He threw in an LMA and went on cruise control, just like every one of us here would do, including myself. And he noticed that her CO2 started going up during the case. And so what do you all notice here on a patient breathing spontaneously with an LMA when their CO2 starts going up? We don't really think much of it, do we? We say, oh, okay, that's the typical hypoventilation from being anesthetized with an LMA. She's on sevoflurane. And so we sometimes will give a little squeeze of the bag, right, to assist. But her CO2 wasn't coming down. And he started to get a little worried. And then the surgeon who went to put in the implants, the breast implants, said to him, "She's a little tight. Can you give me a hand here?" And so the anesthesiologist goes, "Well, he just needs a few minutes to get the implants in. I'm just going to give her a little succinylcholine." Well, it turned out that right around this time, she starts biting down pretty hard on the LMA. In fact, to the point where she can't even ventilate. They put in an antecubital IV, which I would never recommend, because what happened then, and it's hard to know whether the succinylcholine got in or not, she had a flexion contracture popping out her IV. Can you imagine how chaotic this situation is? You're in a plastic surgeon's office, in Florida no less, the bastion of healthcare. And so all of a sudden, she's got no IV, she's having a severe MH reaction. There's four people in this entire surgery center. It's the anesthesiologist, the surgeon, a nurse, and a receptionist. Luckily, believe it or not, well, I shouldn't say luckily because unfortunately Stephanie died, the plastic surgeon's office had done an MH drill 6 weeks before that. Can you imagine a plastic surgeon doing an MH drill? I couldn't believe it, but it's true. They got the dantrolene right away, but they could not save her. Potassium, when she got to the local emergency room, was 12. Her temperature went up to 109. And once you get that high, there's essentially no survival. So this really goes back to the point that most MH deaths are from hyperthermia. And if you start thinking MH, even if the patient's not hot yet, start thinking about bringing their temp down, because that's pretty much the only thing that's going to save them, except for getting the dantrolene as soon as possible. Joe Tobin was at Wake Forest, recently retired from being the chair there. He reported in JAMA a few years ago, a 12-year-old who had acute MH in the operating room. And they treated him. He did fine. He went home. But then he came back. They have a biopsy center there. They showed he's MH susceptible. But 8 months later, he developed a temperature of 108 on the football field. And this started our thinking that people who have had heat stroke or exercise-related heat stroke might be MH susceptible. And I'm not going to go through all the literature here in this room, but suffice to say, there's enough now from being done at the Army Hospital in Bethesda on soldiers returning from Iraq or Afghanistan in hot climates. We're getting about a 50% hit rate on the MH mutations. So any patient with exercise or heat-induced rhabdomyolysis, if it's otherwise unexplainable, I would now consider MH susceptible. And now we can't leave here without talking about some of the awake cases. We all hear of these patients that trigger while awake. And this is a pretty bizarre thing. It's rare. We know of 7 known cases. They've been reported in different places. And I had the unfortunate experience of being the hotline consultant during one of these cases. It's an interesting story. Sad, of course. A friend of mine who's a pediatric anesthesiologist, she goes to visit her sister in California. Her sister's a single mom. She's got about a 6 or 7 year old little girl. And they go to the beach and it's a nice day. And the girl's got a little bit of a cold and she's running a temp. And they decide to come in from the beach and they check her temperature and it's 107, something really ridiculous. And they get alarmed, they bring her to the emergency room and they treat her temperature right away. And the pediatric anesthesiologist says to her sister, "You know, something's not right here. She needs to get checked out." One thing leads to another. The mom moves across the country to the Boston area where I get a call that she's presented to Newton Wesley Hospital in full cardiac arrest. With the same story as Stephanie, her temperature is 109, her potassium is 12, and she unfortunately wasn't able to be saved. She did have a mutation. So these cases are out there. We have a kid from Florida who triggered in the backyard and died, unfortunately. And they're rare, but they're out there. I just want to shift gears a little bit. I really like this sign. I was visiting Children's Hospital in the Midwest, and as I'm waiting for someone to come get me to take me to Grand Rounds, I noticed a sign. It's right outside the pharmacy. It says, "To protect private patient information, only one family allowed at the desk at a time. But your last name will appear on the monitor when your prescription's ready." How's that for HIPAA, huh? Let's talk about some practical things. Anesthesia for known MH patients. So obviously you're going to do a non-triggering technique. Any kind of TEEV is fine. Carefully monitor and tidal. Normal discharge criteria. So years ago, the M House used to say 4 hours. There's really no good justification for that. You could just send your patients home whenever they're ready. And M House says that the ASC should be adjacent to the hospital. That's our official position. However, if you ask me on the side or in a room like this, or if I'm lecturing, I'm going to say that I think it's okay that you could do an MH susceptible patient anywhere you want. In fact, I would go even further to say that's even safer, because you don't know when Stephanie's going to come through your door. You don't know when anybody that you anesthetize on a daily basis could have a mutation that no one knows about. But the MH-susceptible patient, you know, and you're going to treat them as if they're MH-susceptible. Well, at CHOP, where I come from, we don't have that policy. We do not allow MH-susceptible patients in our surgery centers, and it's for one reason and one reason only: throughput. We just don't want to have to think about it. We don't want to have to change a machine or put on the filters or whatever you're going to do, draw up the propofol into your infusion pump. We just don't want to think about it. So that's the reason we don't allow patients into our surgery centers that are MH susceptible. That's it. If you're going to prepare your machine, there's four alternatives. There's some really impractical ones, like you could flush through the machines, put the sign on that says MH precautions, make sure no one turns on the vaporizer by accident. The problem here is that all the machines are new, and we really don't have very good data on how long to flush out these machines for. And I can't tell you any good data because it doesn't really exist. Some machines are 40 minutes. I saw one report 2 hours. So this is a really confusing area. You could bring in a new machine that's never been used with gas. Some operating rooms have these. I can't imagine how practical that is. You could use an ICU ventilator. Again, that's not very practical, but luckily nowadays we've got these charcoal filters. I don't know if you've all heard about these things. They pop onto your inspiratory circuits. Doesn't take very long to flush out the machine within minutes. You don't even need to delay the case. It's the normal turnover. Within minutes, it will suck up and absorb all the anesthetic that's remaining in the circuit. And as long as you don't turn the vaporizer back on, you'll get a clean circuit without changing anything else. I think they cost $40 each, $80 for a pair. A place like CHOP, where we have so many kids with so many different diseases, we use about a couple a week. But it's certainly so much easier than changing out the machine and doing that whole rigmarole. Some new recommendations for treatment of MH. Let's go through those. Obviously, you want to mobilize personnel. It's really hard in a surgery center. But if you're not, if you got people to come, get everybody in to help you, give dantrolene. Dantrolene is the most important treatment. I talked about ice and cold baths to prevent mortality, but you got to get the dantrolene as soon as possible. There's a new kind of dantrolene. The old kind is called Dantrium and Renovo, I think it's called. That's 20 milligrams per vial. Each vial has to be reconstituted with 60 mLs of sterile water. It's a pain. There's a new kind of dantrolene that was approved this year by the FDA. It's called Ryanodex. It's remarkable in that it has 250 milligrams in a 5 ml vial. So it's a lot easier to use. Arrange transfer. If you're in a surgery center, call 911 right away. Get the patient to an emergency room as fast as possible. In fact, anybody here who works in a surgery center should have an agreement with the closest local hospital to make sure that they have dantrolene and they know what you're talking about. So when you call up and you say, hey, I got an emergency, I'm sending over somebody to your emergency room who has in full blown MH. I need you to give them dantrolene as soon as possible to tap into your hospital stores. Just make sure that they know what you're talking about. Call the MH hotline if you have time. Let's talk a little bit about Ryanodex. It's by a new company, relatively new, called Eagle Pharmaceuticals. They were able to use a proprietary technology to hyper-concentrate it into 250 milligrams and 5 mLs, decrease time to preparation, less volume load, obviously. And we now have one, hot off the press, just a couple weeks ago, one successfully treated case from Indiana. It was a two-year-old undergoing cleft palate. Typical case, the CO2 kept going up, going up, going up. They really weren't sure. The temp starts going up. And the surgeon, another plastic surgeon, who'd have thought, said, you know what? I've seen this before. Let's just treat. They had just gotten Ryanodex into the hospital, and the end title came down like that. So it's a pretty convincing case. We'll get some genetics on the baby, hopefully, and confirm it. More data next year. All we have is one reported case using Ryanodex. It seems to work really well. Ryanodex contains, I get a lot of questions about that, including today, subclinical amounts of mannitol. So remember, the versions of dantrolene that we've been using for years has a lot of mannitol in it. Mannitol helps solubilize the dantrolene a little bit, but it also, I think one of the reasons they put so much in is because we're just giving so much volume, and we wanted to help diuresis patients, especially if they were going to develop myoglobinuria. The new formulation does not have very much mannitol in it. It's a very small amount that doesn't really do anything clinically. And in fact, when we discussed this at our MH meeting in September amongst all the hotline consultants, we agreed to take that out of our website. So hopefully soon, I don't know if it's there yet, we're in the middle of making changes, you will not see give mannitol or keep Lasix on your carts. We really feel that the treatment of myoglobinuria should be left up to the intensivist or the nephrologist, whoever's managing this patient's continuing myoglobinuria in the ICU. You probably here in the room know more about Joan Rivers than I do, but I'll tell you what I know about it. Even if it's not true, the principles still hold. If you're going to use propofol, you have got to have succinylcholine, because every once in a while, as we all know, someone will get into trouble. If you're going to use succinylcholine, you have to have dantrolene. I can't tell you how many places I've heard of that either have succinylcholine and don't stock dantrolene because they want to save the $2,600 a year or every 2 years, or that won't stock sux if they're using propofol only because they don't want to have to stock dantrolene and some crediting body is telling them they have to do it. I just can't imagine it's all that much money. M-House has been asked on several occasions by different state societies and whoever to take off the recommendation on our website that says that any anesthetizing location that uses triggering agents, so gas or sux, has to have a good amount. We're saying 700 milligrams of Ryanodex because that's to treat an average patient, and we will not take it off. We really do put patient safety at the forefront, and those recommendations are going to remain. One last thing I mentioned to you earlier about a woman that died from MH, she did not get dantrolene because she was on calcium channel blockers. We realized that language on our website was confusing and that should be taken off already or soon. If you have a patient who's on calcium channel blockers who develops MH, please give dantrolene. Please, please, please. All we really meant from that was if you're in a situation where the patient's developing some kind of arrhythmia from MH or, say, hypertension, do not use calcium channel blockers at the same time as you're using dantrolene. There's some really insufficient animal data that shows that that could cause even more mortality. I want to show you something new we're doing at CHOP. We built all these new ORs with this great laparoscopy equipment. We've got big screen TVs everywhere. So we developed this cognitive aid system. Hopefully all by now have heard of cognitive aids. That's like, why would you memorize how to save someone's life when you could pull up something out of your pocket and read it? So MH is included amongst our emergencies. There's anaphylaxis or cardiac arrest, and you can name all the others. But in the case of any one of these emergencies occurring during anesthetic, the circulating nurse goes to the computer, she hits a switch, a hot button, and on all the screens in the OR, this pops up. So no one has to guess how to treat an emergency. Some last words on testing. Unfortunately, contracture testing is still the gold standard. There's only a few places in the United States and Canada that do it. It's really impractical for people to get this done. Genetic testing is getting hotter and hotter, and we've got these, oh, this is perfect for the talk, 3 hotspots where MH mutations are found. There's a bunch of different labs now that test for MH. Again, hot off the press here last week in the Post. The European MH group finds new mutations. It hasn't been updated in years. You can't get hotter than that. So, and we now have 36 MH-causing mutations. Prevention Genetics is the lab we use the most. There's a couple others. Prevention Genetics is now using something called next-gen sequencing. I'm sure there's a lot of guys here, people who know more about that than I do. It costs about $1,700 to sequence someone's ryanodine gene. And most insurances pay for that. And the company's really good about working with patients. Now, here's the rub. If you send someone for a genetic test to prove that they're MH positive, it's only good if they're positive because we don't know all the mutations that cause MH. And it's a lot easier than the contracture test because you could just send blood or, you know, buccal smear or whatever. You just send it by mail to the company. And for $1,700, they'll do it. The real usefulness of this is that if you find a mutation, then you can sequence anybody else in the family looking for the same mutation. A lot less expensive. It's $250. So the real usefulness of genetic testing now is only if it's positive. If it's negative, it doesn't mean anything. You're back to square one. The only way you can prove someone's not MH susceptible is with a contracture test. Unfortunately, it's not very practical.
Thank you, Dr. Littman. PGA 70 is scheduled for December 9th to the 13th, 2016 in New York City. For information on this and other upcoming CME meetings from the New York State Society of Anesthesiologists, visit nyssa-pga.org.